Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 5 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee. I'd just like to thank everyone for tuning in and being an encouraging audience over the last few years, and I'm sure you will enjoy this season as well. We'll take some deep musical dives together in the coming months, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of these conversations I've been having with some incredible musicians and music producers with you. We have a couple of continuing sponsors that help to bring you each episode this season. The first is Union Tube and Transistor, making incredible guitar effect pedals out of Vancouver, BC. My old pal Chris Young at Union has been laying stuff on me for years, starting with his prototype Buzz Bomb pedal about 15 years ago. Since then, he's become a leading light in boutique pedal manufacturers with an extensive line of pedals like the Moore pedal, the Lab compressor, and the Sone Bender that are constants in my recording world. Check out their line of pedals at uniontone.com. And the second sponsor for the season is Black Mountain Thumb Picks. I've been using these myself for several months, and I think they're great. Cole McBride, the owner, is trying to make everybody happy and now has medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz tipped, left-handed, and regular and extra tight spring tensions available. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. So even though I've been doing this podcast for about 5 years, my heart just isn't into hounding companies for advertising dollars. So as always, this show mostly relies on listener support to keep going. And thanks to everyone that has done that in the past, it's a huge help to know that there's people out there willing to kick in to make it all possible. So if you're interested in doing so, there's a few simple ways to help out. First of all, please just tell your music nerd pals about this show. Word of mouth is probably the best way to get the show heard more. If you're in a position to kick in a bit financially, you can make a one-time donation or join in on my Patreon account, which is a monthly donation billed directly to your credit card at any amount of your choice. You'll also get access through Patreon to some private videos and other stuff as I make it available. And the third way that you can help out is to buy a t-shirt or other swag as it comes available. You can have a look at those or make a donation or join the Patreon all at the new website, which is www.makersandshakerspodcast.com. And please don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get them from. And while you're at it, folks, don't forget to have a listen to our offshoot show called One Life featuring Jim Burns. It's a fun concept podcast involving live improvised music and off-the-cuff storytelling. I think you might dig it. And finally, please follow the show on social media. I have links to Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook all on the website as well as a YouTube link. And that YouTube channel actually is going to get a bit more action this year. In the past, I've just put up links to some live performances, but I will be starting a video series this year about music and recording that I think you might dig. So please subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. Links are all at the top of the page at www.makersandshakerspodcast.com and at my personal website, which is stevedawson.ca. So that's about it for the biz side of things. Let's get going. On to this week's show. Hey there, folks. Welcome to the show. This is episode number 118 with my guest today, Rob Baker. Rob is a great guitarist and songwriter and truly an icon of Canadian music, having spent 33 years in probably the most impactful Canadian band of all time, the Tragically Hip. This is the final episode of season 5, and I would just like to thank all the listeners who've tuned in over the last bunch of months. It's been a pleasure bringing the show to you, as always. I've already started working on season 6, so it's coming, but we'll be off for a couple months here while we get those shows produced, and I'll be returning the first week of April, and we're looking at a 20-show season 6, And thanks again for your support with reviews and subscriptions on Apple Podcasts. And I believe Spotify is now allowing reviews. So all that stuff is easy to do, free, and really helps me out. And of course, a big thanks to our financial supporters through the year, both one-timers and through Patreon. I couldn't do it without you. And even during the off-season weeks here, it's much needed and appreciated as well to bring you these new episodes and help covering the costs to make them all. So, and a big thanks to James Dennis, who pitched in this week. So thank you, and thanks to everybody for your help. Just wanted to keep you up to speed on a few things before we get rolling here that are coming up. First off is I have some new music coming out in 2022, and there's going to be 3 albums worth of music. If you feel like getting your mitts on any of that, you can pre-order them now at stevedawson.ca. And I'll also be doing a tour in the spring, and those dates are coming together now. They're mostly in Western Canada, but they are elsewhere as well. So check on those at stevedawson.ca. Hope to see you out there. Secondly, I just wanted to let you know, if you know of any youngsters out there who write their own songs, we're doing our annual Henhouse Express Junior contest right now. Basically, they send in a song and we record, mix, and release it for them free of charge. It's open now until the end of January, and all proceeds generated from those released songs will be going to the Sarah McLachlan School of Music, so it's a great cause too. And thirdly and lastly, the first ever Henhouse Hang is on and happening September 19th through 22nd of this year, 2022. It's basically a 4-day intensive recording experience here in Nashville at my studio, The Henhouse, focused on recording roots and Americana music. And we'll be taking over a wicked little boutique hotel called the Urban Cowboy that's right around the corner. And we'll work in my studio every day with myself and an engineer who I've made tons of records with over the years, Sheldon Zaharko. And we'll be doing a little sightseeing as well around Nashville on a couple of the mornings. And it should be tons of fun. There's currently only 6 spots left, so hop on it now if you want to come and hang. You can get info on that at my website, stevedawson.ca, and on the front page, there's a link to the Henhouse Hang right there. All right then, on to today's guest, Rob Baker. What can I say about the Tragically Hip? If you know, you know. If you don't, well, you probably should. I don't really need to recap or feel like recapping the unbelievable career of the Hip here in this intro, but for my generation growing up in Canada, they left a undeniably massive mark. I don't know how many times I saw them, probably 5 or 6 over the years, but it was always an incredible experience. And for me, when I was first starting to play in bands and their albums Fully Completely and Day for Night came out, they left a huge impression on me, and seeing them live was incredible. They always struck me as unwaveringly creative and adventurous, and clearly just wanted to make music in their own way, ignoring trends and just doubling down on their own unique brand of rock music. For anyone not from Canada, they may have slipped under your radar, but the heights they achieved here were staggering. Multi-platinum albums, some of the biggest stadium tours in Canadian history. The roadside attraction tours were massive events as well, and they helped to promote other bands with those, which was something they always liked to do. When Gord Downie, their singer, was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, they undertook a final coast-to-coast tour, and the last night of that was televised across the country to millions from their hometown of Kingston and will be remembered forever by the whole country. But at the heart of it all, Rob is just a kid from Kingston that wanted to play some rock and roll with his pals, and man, did he ever pull that off. These guys in the band all knew each other from early grade school, and aside from an early exit by a sax player in the Hip's lineup, the band lineup never changed since 1986. After the end of the Hip, Rob took some time off before getting back into his creative space, and he's cooked up his latest project with Craig Northey, known as Strippers Union. Their newest and third album is called The Undertaking. It came out last year, and it was a really cathartic process for him, getting artistic and getting into the studio again, and it was really interesting to hear about the process of making that record. So you can get info on Strippers Union as well as all the Hip's music at thehip.com, and thanks to Craig Northey for hooking me and Rob up, and now please enjoy my conversation with Rob Baker.
From my studio to yours, or vice versa.
Amazing. Where are you? Are you in Kingston?
I am.
So you've always lived in Kingston. Amazing.
I have. I swore I have a house 5 blocks from where I grew up.
Really?
1 block from where I went to public school, kindergarten to grade 8.
Holy shit.
Two blocks from where I went to high school. Wow. And 4 blocks from where I went to university.
Holy
shit. I walked that street every day of my life and said, God, I got to get out of this town. And I bought a house halfway between the two schools.
Did you go to Queens at some point?
I did.
What did you take there?
I took fine arts, painting and print, painting and printmaking, did a minor in music and a minor in music history and a minor in art history. All those years I thought, well, you know, I got to get out and I want to live in Toronto, and which I did briefly, you know. Yeah. I've had 2 different places in Toronto and in other big cities. But yeah, this was always, I'm not a big city guy. I thought for a while I'd live in Utrecht. I took my family over there because I wanted to move to Holland.
I like that town, actually. That's a cool town.
It's a really good town. And we were there for a week. I was trying to convince them this was going to be it.
Yeah.
And it rained. It was just sideways rain for 6.5 days out of a week. my plan just washed away.
Now, you guys had some sort of like cool connection in Holland. Like you did really well in Holland specifically, right, too?
Yeah, I don't know what it was really.
I know they love Canadians there because I've toured over there a bunch and they always just like, there was something about like this connection between a Canadian artist and like the whole thing of like liberating Holland from the Nazis. They still like associate that and they still are like, we love Canadians.
They do. And it seems kind of weird to us, but it happened there, right? It was on their soil, in their homes, in their streets that all that fighting went down. So, obviously it's meaningful and it carries on through the generations, and they have a great dislike of America in Holland because of the Marshall Plan. And I knew nothing about the Marshall Plan until we started touring in Holland and Belgium. And we got great lessons in history. How after the war, the U.S. rebuilt Germany and Japan. But Holland and Belgium, which were just decimated, were left to their own devices.
Oh, okay.
You know, the Allies destroyed the city of Rotterdam. They razed it to the ground, just like Dresden or any number of other places, because the Germans were using it as a port. And the city's gone. Sorry.
Yeah.
Had to do it.
Gotta go. seems like a really weird place to start, but did you guys do a lot of touring over in Europe over the years? Like, I know that obviously like the Canadian thing was a huge focus for you guys, and you did a lot of US stuff over the years as well, but was Europe like a regular thing that you did?
It was very much so.
Yeah.
There was a point where we, you get to a point as a band where you're playing larger venues, and there are only so many big venues you can play in Canada.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, we can do a 3-week tour now, and in 8 months or 9 months, we can do another 3-week tour. But even that's kind of pushing it. We spent a ton of time in the States, you know, 3 hard years of really touring.
Yeah.
And started to feel like we were beating our heads against the wall a bit. So we just said, let's surround America.
Just play everywhere else.
Yeah. So we just made the decision to start touring Europe. And as soon as we loved Belgium, but as soon as we arrived in Holland, it was just like, oh, this is the greatest country on earth. I thought it was, you know, America says it's them and we always say it's us, but I think it might be Holland.
Yeah.
So we would set up shop in Amsterdam and make day trips out. You know, with a day trip, you can pretty much play a good chunk of the continent.
I remember like touring over there and they would be like, oh man, the next gig you are playing is 300 kilometers. You might have to break that up over 2 days. Yeah. I'm like, I think I can handle that one.
it's the Canadian band thing. You know, I always make a joke and the guys cuffed me upside the head for saying it yet again, but as a Canadian band, you work 10 times as hard to get 1/10 as far,
but that's right.
But you do become used to like cramming into a big van and traveling around in 8-hour drives, 12-hour drives. You don't think much of it, really. So
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the new Strippers Union record, just to to kick things off, which I
that
love.
Old thing.
Did you do the cover for that?
I did.
Nice.
Yeah. Lockdown, you know, when they shut the doors, other doors open, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So I had lots of time on my hands for mixing the record and putting together whatever release plans there were. And then I thought, well, why don't I do an illustration for every song?
That's a cool idea.
And I didn't know that that was the direction it would go in, but the illustration started turning out to be pretty good. And I just sort of set myself, I'll do one illustration a day.
Yeah.
No take backs, no crumpling it up and starting over. It's like, take it as far as it'll go.
It's like songwriting, man.
A little bit.
So Craig told me a little bit about the process, but it sounds like you sort of came to him with more or less like intact songs that you had ideas for, and you'd even done like drum parts. And
I have lots of time on my hands these days. I have my own little, I have a painting studio on the top floor, and in the basement here, I have my Pro Tools studio. And I don't know if you can see over my shoulder.
Let's see what's happening back there.
I got a rack of my hollow body guitars, and my Strats are over, my Tellies are there, and my Strats are over there, acoustic guitars, congas, stand-up bass, my keyboards, amps everywhere. Drum kit from the first two Hip albums.
Oh, cool.
Hit that Johnny played and sold to a friend who later
sold back it to me.
Yeah. Nice. So
I recognize that white acoustic guitar from some Hip shows.
Yes, many shows.
Yeah.
Yeah, most of these guitars saw action at some point. I change guitars a lot. So
Yeah.
I don't know how to tune them. So when it goes out of tune, I just give it away to someone.
Does that guy live in your basement? So what's the writing process been like for you? Like, I can imagine that with the Hip, I'd like to ask you about that whole process, but as a separate thing, like when you're writing music for Strippers Union, it's like a whole different thing. Like, you're doing it from the ground up. Is that something you've always done, or was it kind of like a new thing? Because you guys have done, this is your third Strippers Union record. So it was like 05, 11, and now 10 years later. So there's been a long time in between, but is songwriting from the ground up for you something you've always done, or was that like a whole new thing in 05 when you started working with Craig?
No, it is something I've always done, but I did find, I mean, from the moment I got my first sort of a Fostex recorder, the challenge is to see how far you can take it. How complete a demo can you make?
Right.
Can you make your demo into a finished product? That's the ultimate. So, and I use the term product just because that's the term I use. I don't think of them that way. But that was always kind of the thing. I guess I was inspired many years ago by, as an adolescent, by Something Anything, the Todd Rundgren album.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The idea of, that you can do it all yourself, produce, engineer, write, and play all the instruments.
Yeah.
So I've always done that, but I found that when I did it with the Hip and I would take a demo in, the more complete the demo was, the less chance there was that anyone was going to pay attention to it.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. So it was much more a matter of fleshing out my ideas in my studio and then going in and showing them the idea with an acoustic guitar. But the problem with that is that you show them the idea and you have to strip it back to its most bare bones thing. And when you do that, that ends up being your part. Right. Everyone else does the fleshing out.
Yeah, yeah.
And they get all the fun of, coming up with great bits. So it was, your songs always went in unexpected directions. And sometimes it was more than you could ever dream. And sometimes it was more dream than you could handle. So, sometimes it was a nightmare. Sometimes it was awesome. So, but with Craig, or left to my own devices, I take these ideas as far as I can possibly take them. So I'll spend 2 weeks working on drums and, getting little fills right, trying to get the sounds and the balance, and working on bass lines, because I'm not a bass player. So I have to approach it very methodically. Yeah. The keyboard thing, it's ridiculous. I spent, it's like, one key at a time. Just have to nail this. I just have to nail this four bars with one hand, and then I'll get the same four bars with the other hand, and piecing it all together. But it works for me, and it keeps me busy and out of trouble.
So were you coming to Craig like with fully formed, like, did you have lyrics written and everything too? Or was he?
No, in most cases, I come to him with a finished piece of music.
Yeah.
Knowing that, maybe we want to switch up, double a chorus or cut this section out or whatever. It can all be edited. It can all be completely rebuilt or redone. I think of them as roadmaps to get back to that place.
Okay.
The truth is, once I've done them and I put them away, send them in a file to Craig or, put them in a Dropbox or something, I forget about them. I forget how I even played them. I don't know. I listen to them 2 weeks later. It's like, hey, I wrote that. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I have no recollection of doing it because you're just kind of in a zone when you do it. So, but yeah, I give him these finished pieces of music and he'll get a whole whack of them. Like I'll play him 10 things and he'll say, ooh, I really like these two.
Okay.
And we talk about ideas for what they might be about. Or he might say, I have an idea for this one. Or he sometimes draws inspiration from the stupid titles I give them. And the titles are really just a way of finding it again. Well, just a way to find it, because honestly, I'm doing like 50 or 60 of these things a year, probably.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you're prolific in that regard.
Yeah, not fast moving, but I just...
You got a lot of ideas.
Well, I probably reach probably three ideas that I just keep recycling. I don't know. But I spend a lot of time doing it. And as soon as one is done, there's another one ready to go, something. And if I don't have something ready to go, I fool around and I'll work up from a small germ. They don't always start as like developed songs with a verse, chorus, bridge. Sometimes it's just a riff. And it's like, I'll put the riff down. What would be a good drum beat to go with this? And I'll spend some time working that out. Mm-hmm. That usually inspires the next piece.
Okay. Cool. And then did Pat go in and like redo the drums or were you keeping your drums?
Yeah, the original idea for this, I wasn't even sure I was making a Strippers Union record. I just, okay. I ended up with a lot of songs and I thought I have to take these to the next level. Let's put some lyrics on some. Let's find the 10 or 12, ended up being 18, that kind of sparked something in Craig. And we sit down and we write lyrics. Usually we do it together.
Okay.
With him taking the lead. In a couple of cases, he did them on his own. In a couple of cases, I sent him something that had a vocal, some vocals, like a background part or something already on it. Yeah, I think in the back of my mind, I was thinking it was going to be more like a something anything where I would do everything.
Yeah.
And Craig at some point suggested, there are a couple of these tunes that would really benefit from Pat and Doug from having a live rhythm section. I said, yeah, I was reluctant a little bit because of the conceit of doing it on your own. And just that was kind of something I'd always wanted to do, I guess. But I put my hard drive under my arm, hopped a flight to Vancouver, North Van.
This is all pre-COVID that you guys did this, right?
Yeah, I got home less than a week before the first lockdown.
Oh, wow.
So it was really on the front end, It was already, it was going, but it wasn't
a thing.
What it became. So I went out there thinking, well, they're, I can see them on 4 or 5, maybe 6 tunes.
Okay.
But the others I'm pretty happy. I put in a lot of time on the bass and drums and they're sitting in a good place. And got out there and they did 17 songs in 3 days. They're a machine, those two guys.
They are
two halves of one brain.
Pat's got a little bit of energy too.
Yeah, he does. and Doug is
Doug's no slouch either.
No, yeah. Doug will say the most outrageous thing with an absolutely straight face. And he'll be on the floor laughing and he's just looking at you straight faced. Very funny guys. Absolutely brilliant musicians. So
totally.
yeah, they just they knocked it out of the park. And then I thought at that point, well, I can sift through all this and decide which ones will use the live drums, which ones will use my drums. And at the end of the day, there was no comparison. I mean, they really did stick pretty close to
your
the guides I'd given, I guess. But yeah, they just added humanity and feel that it's really hard to do with BFD or Superior Drummer or whatever. Me triggering drums off a keyboard. It's ridiculous. And then spending a week changing velocities. And you know, it's like everything's too on the grid. I got to shift it and humanize it. It's absurd. Yeah, man. They just do it like that.
A song like The Enforcer, that to me, like, that's like a side of your playing that I've never heard before. That's kind of like almost like Burt Jansch kind of inspired, seems to me. Is that
nice reference?
Is that something that's been an inspiration for you, like as far as fingerstyle guitar?
Big time.
Okay.
And I love dadgad tuning.
Is that what that's in? That sounds dadgadish. Yeah.
Yeah, it is dadgad. And I've always loved that tuning. I always have at least one of these guitars in dadgad at all times.
Yeah.
Sometimes I go months without playing anything but dadgad. So it's funny you say Burt, because I thought of that song as being more John Martin.
Okay. Yeah.
And I was kind of, actually when I did it, I was kind of going for a John Martin vibe. And right. I set the keyboards up to have that Fender Rhodes kind of thing. Like, I don't want to know about evil.
Right.
You know, and I was really happy with the way it turned out as an instrumental piece.
And yeah, it would totally work as an instrumental, actually.
Yeah, I handed it to Craig. He said, I've got an idea for this. It's about a hockey enforcer, a fighter. And I was like, I don't see this at all. It's so light and lilting. I don't get it. And he wrote we sat and we talked about it. And we had some laughs writing the lyrics. And I was kind of unconvinced. I don't know. After a couple of listens, it was like, yeah, this is actually, it's kind of perfect. Like,
it's super cool. Yeah.
So it's the best thing about collaborations. Sometimes the hardest thing is to let go a little bit of your vision, what you want to do.
Totally. Yeah.
And after being in the hip for 35 years or whatever it was, you had to let go a lot. You had learned to let go really early on.
Yeah.
Because it's not your vision. It's a collective vision.
Right.
So part of the whole Strippers Union thing as well, it's still a collective vision, but it's my vision and Craig's vision.
That's cool. It's a cool way to do it, where you have like kind of fully realized ideas going in, and then he's able to sort of, with his sensibility and also like sense of humor and stuff, kind of bring that to the table and really change some of the direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really interesting.
Yeah, it's exciting. It takes all these songs that I've, you know, all these things that I've put on the shelf or in a Dropbox, they're just sitting there. And suddenly he breathes life into them and takes them someplace that you just didn't expect them to go.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's inspiring.
So that fingerstyle stuff you're doing, is that something that you've always done and you just never really had a chance, like an outlet for it? Because when, you know, there's a fair amount of acoustic hip stuff over the years, but it's, I don't recall much like as far as like fingerstyle guitar stuff. It's more like strummy kind of stuff. So was this something that you got into more recently, or have you always been into that kind of guitar playing?
I've always been into it.
Cool.
You know, as a kid, 13-year-old kid taking up the guitar, or 12-year-old kid taking up the guitar, used to spend my summers up in Georgian Bay, cottage country. And there was always some guy or some gal who would whip out the guitar on a dock at night, and everyone would sit at their feet and be enthralled, just stare at them. Like, oh my God. And they all played Fire and Rain by James Taylor. and they'd sing, and sometimes they were terrible, but it made no difference. People just like were enthralled by them. I thought, I gotta be that guy. I want to be that guy.
You want to be that guy on Georgian Bay.
Yeah. And I could never be that guy. Still, if I whipped out the guitar on the dock, I'd hold them enthralled for about 20 seconds. And then they'd all go off and do something, because I'm not that guy. So I compensated by learning how to play other things, so I could sit and play with that guy, and that guy's strumming away, and I could finger pick, or I could play little lead fills around what he was doing, and the people wouldn't be enthralled by me, but the guy, the guitar player would go, hey,
you'd be next to him.
That's awesome. The musician would always say, oh, I really like what you're doing. So yeah, or very early on, I really liked Mississippi John Hurt.
Okay.
I was into that whole, you know, the alternating bass finger picking stuff and Travis picking.
Did you learn a lot of that stuff? Like, did you sit down and actually like tear that apart? Was that ever a thing for you?
Yeah, okay. Still do.
Yep.
And, you know, don't want to give up the game too much, but I don't want to say I can't read, but instead of sitting down to read books, I'll pick up sheet music and I'll play through the American Songbook or John Hurt arrangements or whatever. Or pick up classical guitar arrangements and sit on my porch swing and entertain myself for hours.
Yeah.
I guess kind of the way people would pick up a new whatever novel and read.
How old were you when you actually started playing? And was guitar your first instrument?
The family always had a piano. Both parents loved music. My older brother and sister didn't play at all. My sister had a guitar that I would pretend to play. And I taught myself how to read music and play, but I could never really get the two hands going at one time. I got close a bit, but and then probably around age, you know, how old was I? 1973, I would have been 11 years old and listening to David Bowie and Alice Cooper and Led Zeppelin and leaping off the furniture with a tennis racket.
Were your parents into that stuff or was it just like on the radio?
My mother was into Jerry Vale and ballet music.
Okay.
And my dad was into Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller.
Oh, that's good stuff.
And Dixieland jazz. I to this day, I love that stuff. I listen to swing music as much as I listen to anything, really, which is bizarre. But so, yeah, I was probably around that age, maybe 12, when I got a guitar from someone for $30 and had action about an inch off the neck.
Hey, when that's all you know, man, that's like totally playable, right?
Yeah. And I started learning a few chords. And I think for my 13th birthday, I got an acoustic guitar. The Yamaha acoustic that's around here somewhere. I've got it high strung now in Nashville tuning. That Christmas, I talked my mom into getting me a guitar amp.
Oh, big step.
And of course, I got the amp Christmas morning. And I said, fantastic. I'm so excited. The only problem is I don't have an electric guitar. My old man looked at me knowing full well what I had just done.
That is a good stunt to pull.
So he took me out and we got a guitar that was like a 2-year-old Strat. And it was brown. It looked like the one Robbie Robertson played. And I didn't know a Strat from a Telly from a Les Paul. Really had no idea, but it looked like Robbie Robertson's guitar, and that was all I needed. So
so that's like early 70s, something like that?
Yeah, and, probably 75.
Do you still have 13. That guitar?
Yeah, that was my main brown Strat that I played.
Oh, shit. Okay.
It was the guitar I played everything on through almost every song through the first three records.
Amazing.
And then after that, it became my open E guitar, and I played it at every gig the hip ever played.
Wow, that's incredible. Like, what else were you into at that point? Like, were you, it was like all the rock stuff of the day, and were you listening to any blues stuff? Like, were you going any further back, or was it just like whatever was on the radio you were digging?
No, the source has always been a driving motivation for me. So, and I always say, it's absolutely true that when I found the Rolling Stones, when I discovered the Rolling Stones, like Columbus discovering America, when I found the Stones, they were very good about directing people back. So if if you like our version, check out Muddy's version or check out Howlin' Wolf, which of course I did because they said to, and they weren't wrong. So, yeah, I did that whole deep dive into Chicago blues and folk blues, country blues. And they led me to reggae music and R&B and soul music. They set me off on quite a journey. There was a whole period in high school where I was a little white Rasta, smoking great big fat coin cones. sitting in a sunray reading the Bible and with my guitar at hand. And, you know, I did
not much has changed.
There's a whole bunch of trips I went on for a for a period of time in, I was into, it was almost exclusively Tom Waits, Ricky Lee Jones, and Miles Davis.
Nice, man.
That was like a couple of years of my life, really.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I was into crazy stuff. I loved John McLaughlin.
Mahavishnu.
Yeah, I loved all that stuff. And that led me to Indian music, which I still love. At a certain point, it was like, well, I can't play the John McLaughlin stuff.
Right, right.
The Chuck Berry stuff seems more approachable than the John McLaughlin stuff.
Was there a band that let you dig into like really honing your blues chops as a youngster?
No, not really. It was more of a solo pursuit. But, you know, I had a band starting in grade 9 with Gord Sinclair, and I had a band.
Amazing.
And, you know, we'd play The Who, The Stones, Led Zeppelin, Rush, did a killer version of Bastille Day.
Nice.
All these In the Mood, all those tunes. And then punk
classics.
Hit. And it was, you know, I think we learned the Sex Pistols album in one day. And we were on our way. And then it was The Clash's first album, Teenage Head's first album. And we were gone. And we started playing high school dances as kind of a punk band. And we'd throw in, you know, some Who tunes, Stones tunes, and whatever. But it was, you know, about 50% punk songs of the day.
Were you just kind of playing around Kingston as teens?
Yeah.
Is that
right? Yeah, high school dances. We'd play public school gyms, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. Awesome. And, that was back in the day when the high schools used to get bands to play at dances. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And there was another, I guess I would have been in grade 13. They still had grade 13 back then. And there was a band from grade 12. And they got a high school dance. We'd already played two high school dances, but there was an up-and-coming band we didn't like that much. And they had a singer. And we were like, God, their singer is so much better than we can do. This guy's pretty good. It was Gord Downie, of course. The singer in the competing band. And the guitar player was Fintan McConnell, who's from the band The Mahones. I don't know if you know Mahones. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, they were the competing band in high school. And then after high school...
You nabbed Gord.
Well, after high school, he got into another band with Fintan. And he said, well, I'll join your band, but you got to get Rob Baker on guitar player. He felt that I was a serious musician that would up the level of the band.
Mm-hmm.
Agree to be in it if I was there. So I went in as a mercenary.
Okay.
I had cash payment every show. Yeah. Very funny. And after a couple of years of doing that, we got to the point where we were kind of the hot band in Eastern Ontario.
Yeah.
And we were playing 4 or 5 nights a week. But Gord and I were both trying to go to university at the time. And it was getting a little hairy. So we quit that band and decided we'd form a band and just have some fun with it. Just, you know, play a couple of gigs if we got the opportunity, but basically focus on our studies. And that band was the Hip, of course. So.
Wow. So that didn't really pan out.
Yeah. It kind of sabotaged our studies. That's for sure.
How quickly though, like what was the trajectory of the super early Hip stuff? Like I grew up in Vancouver and you're older enough for me where I wasn't aware of what the super early days were like. Were you touring mostly just around Ontario for a couple of years? Was that the...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
and playing like universities and dive bars and stuff like that?
Yeah. We would basically in sort of 84, 85, it was almost exclusively Kingston. Yeah. We might venture as far as Belleville, Brockville, you know, sort of an hour in either direction. But
ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And we would play anywhere. We'd play a health club. We'd play a Sweet 16 party. We would play a Christmas party. Then we'd play a biker picnic. And then we'd play the university. Sometimes we'd do 3 gigs in a day. We actually used to do that stuff. So, and the deal, I booked the band at the time. And I would never say no as long as they met our conditions. And the conditions were everyone in the band walks away with a $50 bill.
Yeah.
And we drink for free.
Okay.
We don't pay for PA. We don't pay for lights. You can cover that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll play in the dark if you don't want to pay for lights. Doesn't matter. We don't care. We need a PA system. We each need $50 and we need some beer.
Well, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
That seems to have worked out rather well. You upped the ante a little bit over the years.
Yeah, a little bit.
As far as like the two guitar thing goes, I'm always interested in that. Like,
we weren't always two guitars. When we first started out, we had a sax player.
Oh yeah, right. So that's like the I noticed that like in looking through the history of the band, I noticed that you had a sax player until like 86 or something.
Yeah.
And then since then, like that was the last lineup change.
Yeah, that's right.
That's crazy.
Davis Manning played sax because we thought of ourselves as much more of a R&B band.
Okay. And so he was like the Bobby Keys of the Tragically Hip.
Yeah, we did, sax seemed like a natural thing for us to have
at
the band. I don't know why. And he played a bit of acoustic guitar. He was a bit like Jim Croce. Like he would sit down with an acoustic guitar and he was that guy that would have the whole room enthralled. Everyone would stop what they're doing, gather around and he'd tell stories and you could hear a pin drop. He was that guy. He was a wild man. But he was a great musician, wrote great songs. And he kind of gave us strange credibility because he was an older guy. He looked a little bit like Charles Manson, but with sort of silver, dark, wild hair and playing the sax with his shades on. he was a pretty good guy. And
so what happened to him?
I think he tried to kill Gord Sinclair one day. Okay. And
that was the end of that.
We tried to make it as a four-piece for a while, and I didn't enjoy it, being the only guitar player in the band. Anytime I went to play a solo, it felt like the bottom dropped out a little bit.
Yeah.
A lot. And we had a friend from high school, Paul Langlois. His dad was our gym teacher.
Really?
And he was a bartender at Red Lobster, and he was going to go off and try his hand at being a singer-songwriter in Nashville.
Okay.
And we said, don't do that. Join the Hip. And he said, I don't really play guitar well enough. He used to come to all our shows. We'd get so mad at him because there'd be lots of gals there. And he'd be up on the floor dancing and dancing with all the girls. And then he'd catch the first two sets, but he'd always leave after the second set with the prettiest girl. And we were like, I'm that good. We need to get him in the band so he's not raiding the audience. So he got him to join the band. He said, I'm not that great a guitar player. I only know about 4 chords. And he said, it's easy. Any idiot can play the guitar. You'll learn. And he became a fantastic player very quickly.
Were you sort of showing him the ropes in some regard? Or did he just like sit down and like really woodshed? Or what was that all about?
We never really ever sat down and said, okay, I'll play this and you play this and we'll weave this way. It's much more an intuitive understanding, and you can hear, if you listen through the years of our records, you can hear the way his playing changed and developed and became
it really did
and you start playing more intricate lines, and I was happy to lay back and give him space and whatever. So it wasn't a matter of him. He's an intuitive musician and he figured it out very quickly. We were at a point as a band that we could have you know, picked the hot shot player from Eastern Ontario. And it, our approach was always, it should be about friends. Friendship comes first. And let's take someone who we get along with, who we can spend 6 hours in a band with.
A lot to be said for that.
And they can learn how to play the guitar. Yeah. So the musical thing is secondary. The friendship yeah. fun thing is kind of what being in a band is about. So
yeah, yeah. And were you guys all super tight right from the get-go? Like that was definitely the bond was just like...
Yeah, Gordy Sinclair and I grew up together. He moved in across the street from my parents when he was one and I was three. And I remember the day he moved in, I remember playing in the sandbox in his backyard.
Amazing.
So, yeah, wow. He's almost 2 years younger than I am, year and a half. Yeah. So we were tight, and Gord Downey and Paul Langlois had been best friends through high school.
So they were tight.
Kind of a natural.
And how did Johnny Fay fit into the thing? Was he a buddy of somebody's too?
Well, when we formed the band first, we had three rehearsals in my parents' basement. And the guy we had slated to play drums was doing engineering at Queen's, and he missed the first three rehearsals, didn't show up.
That's no good.
And so we said, we got to find someone else. This isn't going to work. I think it may have been Gord Downey said, there's a kid, Johnny Fay. He's still in high school, but I hear he's a hotshot drummer. So call him up. Just get him over here.
And it sort of gelled right away. It was obvious that he was the guy.
Yeah, he was a good, solid drummer. He was much more jazz-oriented in the beginning, I think.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he'd been doing, like, summer stuff at Berkeley.
Oh, okay.
He was very adaptable, and he was very funny. He had a very funny, caustic sense of humor.
That's important.
And if you've been in a band, you know that humor...
I know a lot of funny drummers.
Humor gets you through a lot.
Yeah, man.
You know what? Humor and anger... work together well, and drumming and anger, drumming and frustration. I think there's something, there's a bond there.
Yeah.
Funny drummers is a thing though.
Pat Stewart is another good example of that.
Yeah. It's a wild man.
He is.
Good Pat Stewart story. I was in a hotel in Victoria and I was having a lot of trouble sleeping. So it was about 3 o'clock in the morning. I was like, God, I got to go to sleep. I can't stand it anymore. Struggling, I climbed into bed. I was just starting to drift off, and I heard all this laughing in the hallway. And I jumped up. I said, "That's Pat Stewart. I know it is." And I swung the door open, and sure enough, it's Pat. And they're like three or four people, and there's a gal with them. They just played a gig. I don't remember who was with them, but
yeah,
four or five people, and one of them is a gal, and I'm standing in the doorway. I said, "Pat Stewart," as I ripped open the door. And he's like, "Buddy," and he grabs me and he's swinging me around in the hall, and I'm stark naked. And he's swinging me around and I'm flying. And every time I swing past the door, I'm kicking the door open with my foot, because if the door closes, I'm done. I'm locked out naked. So I managed
to keep... How does that story end?
Well, I managed to keep the door open. They all piled into my room. I got dressed. We called room service. We sat up till dawn.
That's a good cure for not being able to sleep right there.
Yeah, I didn't want to sleep. I felt like I had to, like I owed it to someone. Maybe me.
Tell me about your early recording experiences. You know, that I like to kind of focus on recording on this show a bit. And, you know, obviously through the years, your approach has changed, and like both to tone and to approach of parts and stuff like that. But early on, it seems like you were kind of like modeling yourself after the Stones in a way, with the two guitars and one sort of doing pretty straight up rhythm and one's, you know, basically playing lead. Those first records, like there's the EP, I guess, the Tragically Hip that came out in whatever it was, 87, I guess. Yeah. And then Up to Here was 89, I guess. Both those records are pretty like meat and potatoes kind of rock and roll guitar. What was the studio experience like for you? Like as a musician, as a guitar player, were you going in and laying stuff down live, or what was the process like on those early records?
It was laying stuff down live. Absolutely. Yep. We were a live band. That was what we were good at. Studio was new to us. And why go in and do something that you don't know if you're any good at?
Right.
Feels like it's a waste of time and effort. Just go in, set up like you're playing a show and do the best you can and let someone record it. And when we went in to make Up to Here and Road Apples with Don Smith, he was suggested to us by our A&R guy at the time, Bruce Dickinson. He suggested Don Smith. And we were like, Don who? Don't know anything about him. He said, well, you just finished doing the new Roy Orbison album, which ended up being Roy Orbison's last record. And before that, he did the Keith Richards solo album.
Oh, the Expensive Winos one.
Yeah. We're like, Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, we want him to produce this. That works for us because we're all way into Roy Orbison and Keith Richards, of course.
Right.
And then we learned more that he'd done all this. He'd done the Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers albums.
So he's in Memphis, right?
No, he's a California guy. But between he and Bruce Dickinson, they decided Memphis would be a good place for us to go and record Arden Studios. Well, I think they intuitively understood something about us. And it was that, again, it's back to this idea of the source.
Yeah.
That's always been big
for
us.
Put these guys in a hot, sticky, legit Southern studio and see what comes out.
That has a real music history.
Yeah. Arden's, that's got an incredible history.
We would have known a lot of the music history, but there was a ton that we didn't know already. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, exciting, educational in every respect, from the food to the culture to the studio time.
Was that your first time out of Canada, like as a professional?
No, as a young band, long before we recorded, we used to go down and play Watertown and Syracuse, which are just across the border for us. You know,
okay.
Watertown's an hour away. Syracuse is 2 hours away.
Okay.
So, you know, upstate New York. And I'd been to New York City many times, Washington, D.C., and various places. So it wasn't our first time out of, you know, first time to the States, but crossing the border to go and make Up to Here, the border guards decided to fuck with us.
Uh-oh.
And they took us all into separate rooms and said, we found a big bag of weed. We found a bag of seeds. We found hash. Everyone got a different story. And then they go to each guy. They talk to someone, interview them for a bit, and leave, make them sweat, and come back and say, you're just talking to one of the other guys. He says he thinks it's you. It's just like,
that is just beyond cruel.
I don't have to cross the border anytime soon. But it was downright evil. And they kept us for 3 hours and we're sweating blood and bullets. And they told us, you've lost your van. You've lost all your gear.
Holy shit.
You're not making an album. And you're going to jail in the U.S. Unless you cough up what you have, in which case we'll let you walk back to Canada. But your gear and your van are gone. And after hours, they said, okay, you can go. And they let us go.
They're just fucking with you.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's terrifying.
They taught us a lesson that we did not need to be taught.
Yeah, no doubt.
We did not need that lesson, but they drove it home pretty thoroughly that you don't mess around at the border.
Yeah.
Take that stuff seriously. And we always did. But yeah, I got down to Memphis with Don Smith and I'm thinking, well, big hotshot producer. He's worked with Dylan and Tom Petty and Keith Richards. I was waiting for someone to tell me where to set my amp up, how to dial my sound in, you know, nothing. Like, I was like, what do we pay this guy for? it became very clear what he got paid for. And he just wanted to capture, he loved our band and he just wanted to capture the way we were. He didn't want to shape it or he just wanted to make it go down on tape.
He wanted to capture exactly what you were doing.
In the most pristine way.
Wow, that's so cool. That's actually a really great way to ease yourself into your recording career, having somebody like that.
Yeah, so we did the first, you know, Up to Here and Road Apples were done that way.
Both of those in Memphis?
No, Memphis and then New Orleans for Road Apples. And again, that's chasing down the source, right?
Yeah, man. So where were you working in New Orleans? Were you at like Kingsway or something?
Kingsway, yeah.
Wow.
Okay. We did two full albums there and parts of two other albums.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kingsway. We love that place. And Kingsway was the inspiration for us to have our own studio, to do that kind of residential studio clubhouse vibe.
Right. I've worked at your place. It's awesome. Yeah.
Came from Kingsway. It's not quite like Kingsway. It's not the 1800s decadence and in a 13,000 square foot mansion. It's it's much more like a wood paneled clubhouse. But
it is a very cool clubhouse, though. I love working there, actually.
And then the third album, after Don Smith, it's kind of chasing down the source, but in a different direction. He went to London, which in a weird way felt like getting closer to the heart of where we were from, early Stones, Yardbirds, that kind of vibe.
This is for Fully Completely, right?
Yeah, which was the big inspiration. And we worked with Chris Sangeritis, who we knew little about, except...
He was like a metal guy.
Yeah, we didn't know that when we went over.
Really?
We found that all out, that he was like the godfather of English metal.
Yeah.
We knew him from producing Concrete Blonde. And we loved Concrete Blonde. We listened to them all the time in the van. We were all over that. Their first couple of albums, Still in Hollywood and God is a Bullet, and some of those tunes, great stuff. We put out a feeler to him to see if he was interested. And he was so enthusiastic. It just completely bowled us over. He said, yes, I want to do the band. When are you playing next? And we said, well, we're playing in Toronto in 4 days. And he said, I'll be there. And he showed up and said, yes, I want to do this band. We could start on this date. He was like way into it. So away we went to London. And his approach was the exact opposite of Don Smith, which was, you have a 5-week session. We'll spend 3 weeks doing nothing but bass and drums. And then you'll have a couple of days to do all the guitars.
Wow.
And then we'll do all the vocals.
All layered and overdubbed. Nothing was done live all of a sudden?
Nothing live.
How was that feeling?
It was very different. It felt very weird. You had no idea what you had until right near the end of the process.
Yeah.
He got fine playing out of us. It was our biggest album.
Yeah, I mean, that was a super iconic record.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess it worked. It's not the most fun way to make a record.
Was it grueling? Like, what? That seems like an exorbitant amount of time to be focused on drums and bass. Like, were you just sitting, twiddling your thumbs, waiting for that to happen? Or what was going on?
No, Paul and I would play almost every take with Gordon Johnny, but we were playing through little Sans amps.
Okay.
So it was just like a headphone affair for us. No one's recording what we're playing.
And it was just strictly to keep those guys in.
Yeah, we'd play context. Just to keep the arrangement and just so that when it came time for us to lay down our parts, we'd already played them hundreds and hundreds of times.
I bet.
And then it was like, I can nail this in one take.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, well, now you have a solo. We'll give you two takes.
right.
And then we'll take the best one. If they're not very good, we'll stitch them together. That was a different approach for us. They're both completely valid approaches. And in a weird way, the Chris approach was more the standard approach at the time.
Right.
Going into the studio and trying to play live. The truth is, you can set up like you're a live band and be a great live band. When you set up in the studio and there's no audience, it's not live. You're not going to get that energy. And as we found through our recording career that if you invited a couple people into the studio, even like, you know, if there are four people in the room with the players who were there just watching and listening, you play very differently.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Did
you have a few people hanging around that would sort of feed that for
you?
We
did that. Yeah, I did that a number of times.
Nice.
I always pushed very hard for doing a record of all new material, but recording it as a live album.
Oh.
Setting up and doing playing the set every night for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And bring in a small audience every night, you know.
That's a great idea.
20 people or something.
Yeah.
Just run through the set and then take the best versions after 2 weeks, take the best versions of each song.
That album in my recollection, it was a real shift for you guys, like into kind of more atmospheric stuff and like away from the straight up rock and roll approach that you had on your earlier records. Were you guys, was the writing process changing too? Like creatively as a band, were you consciously trying to write in a new way? It also seems like live you were experimenting too. Like some of those songs, it seems to me like you were like messing with them way before you recorded them, and they were sort of sneaking their way into either medleys or into gigs. How was that shifting at that time?
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's certainly nothing premeditated, but we weren't big on trying to repeat what we had done.
Yeah.
So
was there pressure on you to repeat what you'd done? Because you'd had success with Road Apples.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they wanted like another Road Apples out of you.
Yeah, that was, they wanted another New Orleans sinking. Do another one like that. Can you make it more Southern blues? Can you do, you know, whatever? Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
We had a record exec one time, actually before that record, before Up to Here, who wanted to sign us. I won't say his name, but he's been the death of many bands.
Okay.
And he said, yeah, we want to sign you guys to a contract. We're going to bring in songwriters to write your two hits on every record, and then you can write the other 9 or 10 songs. And we're going to dress you. We see you guys in fringe jackets.
Awesome.
Yeah.
How did that go?
At that point, we really had no prospects for a recording contract. It was like, this is it. This is our big break. No, thank you. Not going to do it.
But it seems like you never really had a problem with having a record deal. Like you guys got signed to MCA and kind of stayed there until you moved to a different label. But
yeah, was that the EP was on BMG, and then we demoed for Capitol for a long time. Capitol would give us money to go into the studio.
Back in those days.
Record 5 songs. And we'd go in, we'd record 5 tunes, and we'd come out and they'd say, we really like these 2, or we like these 3. Forget the other ones. Feed them to the eels. And then they'd cough up more money and we'd go in again.
Yeah.
We like these 2. After we'd done that for a year, we had 11 songs that we thought, these songs are all really good. Capitol likes them. And MCA came along and said, we'll sign you to a 7 record deal.
And 7 records.
And it was MCA USA, which was important to us.
Yeah.
And we said, yes. Yes, please. We'll do that.
That's unheard of, isn't it, for a Canadian band?
I don't know. Maybe at that time. 7 record deals are unheard of now.
When
they signed us, they said, our A&R guy, brilliant, as I said, Bruce Dickinson, lovely guy. He said, you're not the kind of band that's going to have a huge hit and take off like a rocket. You're the type of band that's going to go out and work, play 200 shows a year for the next 5-6 years.
Yeah, smart dude.
After your 4th or 5th album, you're going to have built up a critical mass of fans. And at that point, you're going to spill over into mainstream success. That was his idea. No one signs bands on that premise anymore.
Right. It's like, well,
you've got about 3 days to have a hit. your song's not a hit in 3 days. Everyone moves to a new project.
Yeah, that whole philosophy went out the window years ago. That's cool though that you caught the kind of the tail end of it.
Yeah, we're very lucky, and we're lucky too that we never fit into the boxes properly. You know, we were too rocky and too bluesy for a lot of mainstream success at one point. And then everything went to this kind of roots rock thing, roots rock revival and blues revival. And we were way too poppy for them. It was perfect that we just kind of, by slipping through that crack repeatedly, we were able to carve our own groove, I guess. So
at what point did you guys start playing like big venues in Canada? Like, was that Road Apples days or more like Fully Completely?
I don't really know. I don't know. Probably after Fully Completely. I mean, we're certainly playing some bigger shows, you know, big outdoor venues on bills with other bands.
Yeah.
after Rod Apples, but maybe even before then. I don't know. After Fully Completely, it shifted a bit. And then again, after Day for Night, it really shifted. Then we were kind of doing the arena tours.
Were you still kind of focused on touring in the States at that point as well?
Always.
Always did that.
You know, as I said, you can only play so many, there are only so many cities you can really play in Canada.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can play more, but it's hard on you. It's a lot of driving, for not a lot of money and whatever. It takes its toll. So from day one, really, we were focused on playing anywhere. We never really had a nationalist bone in our body and never really considered ourselves nationalist. In fact, the whole idea of nationalism sounds a bit like national socialism to me.
It sure does, yeah.
Yeah, not a fan of that kind of thing.
Back in the studio world for a second, some of the other guys that you've worked with, like Steve Berlin and Bob Rock over the years, I'm just wondering how those, like Bob Rock is like a whole different approach to recording. I know he's very meticulous and like very precise about like edits and like being on the grid. And or I don't know if he was like that with you guys, but I'm aware of that as his general approach.
Yeah, he was not a grid guy,
okay.
But he was very much about cutting drums. Multiple drum takes and cutting drums together to make takes.
Okay.
And he would mic the drum kit. He would have, I don't
100
know.
100
mics. Yeah. 30, 40 mics on the drum kit.
It was just like, shit.
It got a little crazy. And, you know, we did two albums with him. One of them was pretty good. We did two albums with Steve Berlin. One of them was very good. The other one was not so good. But Steve Berlin is a match. We love that guy. Such a great man. And
he
got a lot out of us. The problem for any producer, as Steve Berlin said, working with you guys is like working with the UN Security Council. And he's not wrong. Like, and we are big believers that when you work with someone, you give them the ball. You put your trust in them. You give them the ball and see what they can do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great with Don Smith on the first record. It was great with him on the second one, too, to tell the truth. With Steve Berlin, we did a lot of second guessing of him on the second record.
Why is that?
Because I think you know the producer. You know what their tricks are and the way they work. And mm-hmm. they think that they have a read on you. Mm-hmm. And they think they know how to play you and you're playing them. And you have, I don't know, you just start to second guess each other a little bit. It definitely happened with Steve Berlin, and I think it to the detriment of the second album that he worked on with us.
Was that Phantom Power? Is that that one?
Phantom Power was the first one. The second one was Musical Work. And it should have been probably a 10 or 11 song record. I think it was like a 13 song record.
Yeah.
You need to edit until it hurts, you know? Leave good things on the cutting room floor. Because they don't get wasted. They'll show up one day. His hands were tied by us.
Really?
So I don't blame him in any way. The Bob Rock thing, it was, I think, to some degree, his hands were, I wouldn't say his hands were tied by us, but on some level, he lost the floor with us on the second one. I won't go into too many details about it, but those were not enjoyable records to make for me.
Okay. Yeah. Just less organic and less playing and more kind of like nitpicking and that kind of thing, or
I don't think Don Smith loved our band and understood the band.
Mm-hmm.
Other people come to it with, you know, what's wrong with this band? I know how to make this band big. I know we just need to tweak their formula and do this. And too much of that gets this, you know.
But totally.
Fuck that.
So do you guys have like a huge trail of half finished stuff are the records like a complete picture of what you were working on at the time, or are there outtakes from every record that are
outtakes from every record?
Okay.
As a general rule, we try and, if we knew we were going into the studio, we would try and have 17 songs ready to go.
Yeah.
You'd usually, have jettisoned two by the time you're setting up and ready to roll tape. So you're down to 15. And then you would try and record 15 and cut it to 11.
Yeah.
This is the general rule. In some cases, as the band, as the inmates took greater control of the asylum, we started putting 13 songs on records and watering down the quality of the records, making them, you know, not advisable. As I say, edit till it hurts. And and some producers were better than others about maintaining control.
Yeah.
Generally not. I think there must be some hard to work with.
There must be some good stuff, though, that's just, I guess, just sitting there. Like, is there some potential to release some of the outtakes, or is that just
absolutely. Absolutely. I think there are good songs. In some cases, I felt like I was cursed for a while because my favorite songs were getting left off of every record. Favorite songs from the session. So
you'd track them and you'd love them and they would just get cut.
Yeah. My three favorite songs from Up to Here didn't make Up to Here.
Really?
Yeah. My two favorite songs from Road Apples did not make Road Apples.
So what happened to those? Have they ever seen the light of day, or are they just...
They haven't seen the light of day yet. Coming soon.
Coming soon. I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit about, you know, as a musician, somebody that's played in the same band for whatever it was that the hip was active for, 35 years or whatever, and had such a visible finishing point, you know, like the last tour was so emotional and the whole country was watching basically. And, you know, I wonder how for you, like as a musician, you've grown up, like as an adult, you've been in this situation where there's like time to be on the road with your friends. There's time to make records. There's time off in between. You must've sort of got into like a bit of a role with that through your life. And then to have that come to an end the way it did must have been like really jarring for you artistically and emotionally.
You think? Brutal.
And being able to see that it was coming too. It wasn't like it was a surprise.
Yeah.
What was that like for you? And where has that left things for you?
It's a funny thing being in a band. It's like you're living out your 16-year-old fantasy.
Right.
Which you really have no idea what you're fantasizing about when you're 16. It's so much different, the reality, but
right.
I lived this fantasy all these years and accomplished all these things that you would never imagine in a million years were actually could happen. So I guess that dream had been fulfilled in a lot of ways. You don't ever want it to end.
Right.
You know, don't wake me up. I'm having the best dream ever. But I was at a certain age, mid-50s, just been through, you know, the multi-year demise of my parents and their deaths, and then my wife's parents and their deaths, and then one of your best friends and your career. None of them happened entirely out of the blue, except hearing about Gord's illness, I guess. But it doesn't matter how much time you have to prepare. It's still, you know, the end effect is still the same. And I watched people of my parents' generation, and I don't want to be sexist about it, but in particular, it seemed to be a thing for men of my father's generation that they were what they did. My dad was a judge, and when he was retired as a judge, in his mind, he was nothing. You know, he'd been unplugged and pushed against the wall, you know, no longer of use. And I swore I would not be that guy. And then I found myself sitting home twiddling my thumbs. It's like, it's 8 o'clock at night. I should be pouring my drink now to get ready for the stage, but there's no stage coming. There's no audience. Mm-hmm. There's no tour. And my whole identity, it turns out, was very wrapped up in being a musician, being a guitar player, being a member of a band.
Yeah.
And it really threw me for a loop. I thought I was ready for it. I was ready to be off the road. In my mind, I was. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really know what it entailed. I hadn't seen the whole thing. And it messed me up in a big way. And I thought about, you know, I had self-destructive urges for maybe I just blow my whole life up and do something completely different, change my name, move halfway around the world, whatever. Like, and you have all these nattering voices in your head telling you, you know, what are you going to do now? What's the next act? Right. So my way of coping with it is avoidance, which I'm a master at. So I would come down to my studio and I'd just chase down an idea. And when I'm doing that, the act of creation, playing the guitar or painting, it's the same thing as running or doing yoga or meditating. It's driving all those other voices away. You're not doing shopping lists in your head. You're not planning things or thinking about conversations. You're in the act of doing something and everything else falls away. So I avoided the problems or issues in my life by focusing on this creation of these songs. And at a certain point, there were a lot of songs. So I said, I should fire some of these to Craig, see what he thinks.
Yeah, it's good to have friends at a time like that. Yeah.
Through the act of avoiding, I realized this is who I am. This is what I do. There doesn't have to be another act. I'm a guitar player. I'm a musician. Maybe it's not the same band that it was. Things change. I'm still the same person with the same drives. And it's the same things that get me off and interest me. I'll just keep doing that. Maybe my days of having it be an economic force in my life are over. Mm-hmm. Maybe the money flows out instead of in now.
Right.
Doesn't much matter. I'm still going to do it. So
yeah. Pandemic aside, do you see yourself going out and touring a bunch and like doing the road thing and kind of like reinventing yourself in that way, or not really?
It'd have to make sense for me to do it. I got to a point after, you know, it was after about 25 years on the road where I was one of those people that could sleep anywhere at any time. I had no trouble functioning on 2 hours sleep. You know, I loved the tour bus. It was home for me and travel. And I got to a point where I need to sleep in my own bed. I can't sleep on the bus. I can't sit on a bus for 8 hours. I hate airports.
I feel you.
I ran out of tolerance for it. So to go on the road does not sound appealing to me.
Yeah.
But playing shows, getting up on stage with friends, people that are like my brothers and sisters, you know, Emily and Craig, Pat, Doug, Gord Sinclair, these people are, and my son who I play with on a regular basis, just being on stage with these people is a privilege to be able to play music with your friends. It's
that'll never change.
We should be paying for the privilege of that, not charging money for it. We charge money because you have to
get there,
go through an airport and stay in a hotel. Right now I feel like there isn't enough money to get me up on stage to do that. So
and the studio, the bathhouse, is that something that you guys intend to keep? Like, I don't know what the deal is with that place, but you all,
it's a going concern. It's busy. It's lockdowns right now. Kingston is under a 5-person lockdown, indoors and outdoors, which definitely is problematic at a studio.
Of course, yeah.
But you record smaller acts. But it's an ongoing concern. I'm in there with restrictions willing. I'll be in there in May with a band called The Wilderness.
Producing them or something?
Producing record for them. Yeah, I produced their last record.
Okay.
Going back in and songwriting with my son. You know, keep busy. There's lots of stuff to keep busy with. The Bathhouse Studio is, as I said, a going concern there. If I want to get in there, it's a matter of trying to book like 6 weeks out, trying to find a day or a weekend to get in. But
so you guys own it all together and you share the
cost
as well. The cost. Is Niall still there?
Niall's is still there. And it does well enough for us to keep Niles on salary and keep the studio up and running and updated.
Oh, that's good.
The gear that we need and keep the roof plugged.
I loved working there. I'd love to get back there one of these days.
It's not a get rich. It's not a get rich quick scheme.
No, especially these days.
No.
I can understand that. Well, thanks, Rob, so much for spending some time with me today. I really appreciate it, and love hearing about some of those experiences of yours, and I'm sure other people will like to hear it too.
Good talking to you, Steve.
Okay, thanks, Rob. Thanks for listening, everybody. That was my conversation with Rob Baker. I hope you enjoyed it. I had a blast bringing it to you. I also had a blast bringing you all of season 5, which has now come to an end. And thanks again for listening. Please stay tuned. Check out some old episodes, and we'll be back in a few weeks with season 6. Until then, take care of yourselves. We'll see you then. Over and out. Thanks for listening, everybody. The Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee at the Hen House Studio. Don't forget to follow us on social media, and please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify Podcasts. And you can find us online at makersandshakerspodcast.com. As always, thanks to Jeremy Holmes in Vancouver for help with research. And we'll see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. See you then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.